Stephen Bowen. And to give you a little bio, Stephen was born in Montreal. Lived and worked across Canada before joining the National Research Council as a senior researcher in November of 2001. He's currently based out of Moncton at the Institute of Information Technology and E-Learning Research Group. Stephen has become a leading voice in learning objectives and media data, as well as the emerging fields of weblogs and education and content syndication. Stephen is perhaps best known for his daily research newsletter, OL Daily, or short for Online Learning Daily, which reaches thousands of readers across Canada and around the world. His work also includes the development of educational content syndication systems such as EDU, RSS, and DLearn, along with the design of digital rights management systems for learning resources. Stephen is also frequently to be found on the road giving seminars, like today, and lectures in the field of online learning, including the notable Bunjin oration delivery in Perth, which he gave in Australia in October of 2004. Prior to his employment with the National Research Council, Stephen worked as an information architect at the University of Alberta, hired under contract to design and build a one-stop knowledge learning and resource portal for the province's municipal sector, or Muni Mall. While with the University of Alberta, he also contributed his unique approach to information architecture to projects such as the Alberta Motion Picture Industries Association portal at Pegasus, a learning and resource service for petroleum engineers, geologists, and physicists. He has also worked as an industrial and new media designer at Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba, designing the college's website and launching some of the first online courses that were given from there in Canada. Stephen's formal education is in philosophy, obtaining his BA and MA at the University of Calgary, and continues his studies at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. During his varied career as an undergraduate, he served two terms as editor of the University of Calgary student newspaper, The Gauntlet, and Edmonton distinguished himself as president of the Graduate Students Association for two terms, sitting on the University Board of Governors and Academic Council. He has also worked at Athabasca University as a distance instructor for 7 years, and as the voice of the university's tutorial community, was a representative on Athabasca's university's governing council. He's also taught after completing high school at Ottawa School of Continuing Education while working on a concession stand as a dishwasher. I studied computer science for a year at Algonquin College while working as a telephone equipment installer, and later as a security guard. That's coming home for us. He worked for a year as a computer operator for Texas Instruments in Calgary, and was concurrently working as a pot washer, as a 7-Eleven clerk, while in development educational program for the Arusha International Development Center. Stephen has also been a newspaper carrier, waiter, racetrack, hot dog vendor, and a building cleaner and camp counselor. It sounds like the training field for some of our actors. Very, very broad background, but brings a huge breadth of understanding to the variety of communities that are looking to enter into the e-learning environment. Stephen lives in Moncton with his wife, Andrea. He has three cats, Bart, Holly, and Nadia. He's 45, and one of the distinguishing features, one of his cats was the first feline in Manitoba to have their own website. So I'd say we have an ardent cat person on our hands. There must be one or two more in the audience. There always is. Publications and presentations characterized by the fact that they were referred or otherwise reviewed and formally equipped links and online versions. And there's pretty well not a whole lot in the e-learning environment that Stephen has not been at the forefront of development and design in the Canadian environment as well as internationally. And I invite you to welcome our guest speaker for the morning. Stephen.
Thanks a lot. First thing after I go home, that biography, two sentences. I'm just enjoying the room here. It's another. I gave a talk in North Bay just a couple of days ago, and they put me in an airline hangar, and I didn't expect to be in a similar room so soon. I got all kinds of stuff today, but a few preliminaries. Normally I do introductions, but we have limited time and a lot of people, so I'll just wave at you. The preliminary is this. This is, as you can tell, an in-person talk. What that means is that it's a lot better if it's more than just me talking and you listening and or taking notes. I've got quite a few points, but and you know, I've got a slideshow and a presentation and an agenda and all of that. But I want all of you to feel free at any time to ask a question, make a comment. If you disagree with something, feel free. I doubt that this is a shy group, so I imagine you'll feel comfortable speaking out, and I want to encourage that. If it is the interest of this group that we diverge from the agenda, that we go off on a tangent somewhere, that's perfectly fine with me. I'm not locked into what I have to say. The ultimate purpose of this talk is for you, and so it should go in directions that you're interested in, and I'll adapt. You don't need to adapt to me. I'll adapt to you. So that's the preliminary. Do feel free to contribute to this. Because I'm a selfish, selfish person. And the reason why I do talks like this isn't to get up on a pulpit and start preaching the gospel. It's to learn and to get knowledge and information from all of you. I'll be pretty honest here. I don't know very much about police education. I'm sure few people outside the field do. So you are going to have a perspective, a point of view that is going to be unique to me. And the more you share that with me, the more I will gain from delivering this presentation. Another preliminary note, just so you know, might be the law too. I'll be sensitive to that today. I always record all of my talks, and I am recording now. I guess you can't see it. Normally I show the little squigglies going up and down, but the computer's recording the talk. This recording and this slideshow will be on my website, available on my website shortly after the talk. The slideshow is, in fact, available now. You probably can't see that address from the back of the room. But my website is Downes, DOWNES.ca, as in Canada. And if you go there, it's not posted on the front page right at the moment, but when I go back, I'll post it up on the front page with the recording so that as soon as I'm done here, you'll have the slides, you'll have the recording of the talk, so you'll have the background information that you need. Got a lot of links and a lot of resources. And neat things to show you. And I want you to be able to go back after and have a look, a more in-depth look at some of those. Got a Phil Donahue microphone here, which I might use from time to time. I'm not going to try to speak without... I always feel awkward with one of these because I'm not really a Phil Donahue kind of person. I want to make sure I use the microphone to make sure that everybody in the room can hear me. I know that in a room this size, sometimes people are tempted to go it without the microphone. And I've sat in the very back of rooms like that and going, so it's kind of hard to hear. So I will be using the mic. And actually, if you make comments, either, depending on where you are, right, I'll give you the mic, throw the mic at you, so be ready. Or I'll ask you to speak really loudly. So, that's the preliminaries. Clicker. Here's the plan. I do have a plan. Always takes me a little bit to get warmed up into a talk, too, so, you know, by 12 o'clock or so, I should be right into it. They gave me a clicker, and they did not say which button. I'm technologically illiterate. I'm maybe way to got a laser. Oh, underneath. Oh, there. It's pointing at the screen. Well, I've got four major sections. First of all, I'm going to cover some grounds that you may have already covered a little bit in your earlier sessions. That's to set ourselves a context to locate where we are. It's a starting point for what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to talk about some trends, both in society and the internet generally, and e-learning in particular, because things are moving rapidly. Drawing from those trends, I'm going to do a bit of an outline of, well, what I've just decided today to call e-learning 2.0. It's a takeoff on the concept of web 2.0, but I'll explain that. And then a shortish section which moves from there into what we can expect in the future. So the talk is a kaleidoscope of options. You've probably seen different titles. I noticed there's three separate titles or descriptions of my talk, which I found very interesting. That's not the organizer's fault. That's me being inconsistent. I embrace inconsistency. So don't be too surprised by that. All of these things that you were promised in various titles and descriptions, that we will cover all of those things, but this is the structure I'm planning to do it in. So, how does that sound so far to you guys? Does that sound like... Not a shy audience. Usually I say that, I look at the crowd and I feel like the tiniest... And my eyes are such that I really have to peer. All right. I also got lots of pictures. Let's see if this works. This one will work? Nope.
You're right. Okay.
It's not wild. Well, I guess I can't wander so much. That's okay. I'll wander in my 2-foot space here. And while we're clicking futilely at the slideshow, I just want to welcome everybody who's listening online. I hope the echo isn't too bad.
I'll let you do it here now.
Sure. All right. How can you read that in the back? Is it coming out at all?
Yeah.
All right. I try to make the text big, but it's always a trade-off, right? As I'm sure you guys have seen already. You know, big text, amount of content. Where we are now. And it's sort of funny for me to say where we are now, because I don't really see this as being where e-learning is now, but a lot of what you read in various textbooks, a lot of what you've seen probably in seminars, is based around the idea of the online course. And you see some pictures of typical online courses there. Online course will follow a very traditional design strategy, a strategy typically based in the work that has been done over the years in the field of distance learning. I've always used what I call an ideas model, introduction, which would include things like learning outcomes or objectives, a description, an exercise, an activity or assignment, and then a summary. It's a very ordered presentation. It's typically presented in a linear fashion. It resembles very much, and deliberately so, the course that you would take in a traditional institution. It resembles a lot this presentation, doesn't it? An online course is typically an instruction, some instructional material, very often with some discussion or chat support. These days, very often supplemented with a live online session using a piece of software like Centra Symposium or Illuminate. How many of you have heard of Symposium or Illuminate? A few hands. Okay. These are kind of neat. You're going to run across these because they're not going to go away. I don't have links for them. I didn't even think of them while I was making this slide. Oh well. But if you use Google, I'll say this a lot, just Google such and such. Because half of my brain is on Google. And we just have to live with that. Centra, C-E-N-T-R-A, Symposium, spelled like it's pronounced, Illuminate, E-L-L-U-M-I-N-A-T-E. These are two of a number of products of this sort. What these are online conferencing facilities. They allow a group of people to log on together to share something like the slideshow and to participate in an audio conference. The sound is not bad. It's roughly equivalent to telephone teleconferencing. You get some stuttering sometimes, and there's always a bit of a lag because it's going through the computer. These programs also offer you things like whiteboards, so you can draw little pictures. I've only ever seen them used for doodling. You can draw little smiley faces and things, but the capacity is there. And as well, they can be used for application sharing. The moderator can, if everybody has the same application on their own computer, the moderator can call up the application and then demonstrate, say, the operation of a computer program. And everybody else who's viewing this remotely at home can see the operations, and it'll call up the version, their own version of the program on their own computer. The most common use of that is what's sometimes called chat touring. And that is a session of browsing on the internet using a web browser that is led by the instructor, and then everybody follows along in their own browser. I kind of like them, I kind of don't like them. My big problem with them is you have to be in a certain place at a certain time. You have to be in front of your computer at a certain time, and meet schedules. I'm not good with that, so I've missed as many of these presentations as I've attended. Online courses. Have you seen the phrase page turner yet? Yeah. That's the major criticism of online courses. A lot of the early courses, including courses that I've developed, are what they call page turners, and really they amount to nothing more than a whole bunch of content tossed onto the web. Nowadays, you sort of look at that and say, what a terrible use of the technology. Back here, 10 years ago when this was starting up, just being able to do that was a neat thing. You know, nobody knew you could just put a course on the web, even if it was just a page turner. But contemporary designers will say, and accurately, that you need to do more than that. You need to have instructional elements such as activities, quizzes, interaction, discussion, and all of that to break up the page-turning monotony. That's the state of the art. Well, the beginning state of the art. And I think this is probably pretty familiar ground to you at this point, so I'm not going to linger on that. He says, having lingered on that. Well, with online courses comes the natural evolution, and it really was a very natural evolution. It began in 94, 95, 96. As soon as people had the idea of putting courses on the web, they came up with the idea of creating computer programs that make it easy to put courses up on the web. And these early programs were called, and still are called, learning management systems. I've listed a couple of them there, WebCT. Is a very popular learning management system developed by Murray Goldberg at the University of British Columbia. Blackboard is another one. Thompson has one, right? What one does Thompson have? Okay, that's cool. Thompson. Okay, Thompson does have a learning management system, but I forget what it is just off the top of my head. Thompson, the neat little booth back. I'm going to pick on them all day because they got a booth back there. That's what you get for having a booth back there. Athabasca, don't laugh. I worked for Athabasca for 7 years. I've got stories. I know where the skeletons are. Thompson is... quietly, but very involved in the field of online learning. They've got a wide variety of learning management system, learning resources, stuff like that. They just have books back there. Oh, the computer is reading his email. Desire to Learn is a more recent addition to the learning management system scene. They're based out of Waterloo in Ontario, and recently are becoming very popular with Canadian institutions. It's interesting, people don't realize this, but the learning management system basically was developed in Canada and exported elsewhere, and that's why you see so many Canadian names attached to this. What a learning management system is, at its heart, is an online course in a standardized navigation shell. So,
oh, right.
Oh, this is going to be tricky.
It's an add to favorites. Yeah, right.
Previous. I'm just going to click. I'm just trying to see if this works. Oh, they said the airplanes would fly low. I'm typing blind here, so... why did I get that wrong?
STEPHEN.
That should work. There you go. This is an inside look at Desire to Learn. And again, Desire to Learn, they weren't too happy when I told them that. Fairly characteristic, typical learning management system. We've got settings and things like that. We've got listings of courses. Should be able to find the course. Here's some course content.
That's not very good course content. I did actually find an online course here before.
One of the things I'm not thrilled about learning management systems is they try to do so much that they're often fairly difficult interfaces to use, and people need to actually take, students especially, have to take a training course or something like that, usually about 2 weeks or so, in how to use the learning management system. This is very common in the college and university settings where they do run you through the course beforehand. My take on this is if you need a course to run the piece of software, the piece of software is broken. There are no files on my personal homepage. There is a course here somewhere. There it is. So, there's the typical course. And basically what it'll have is a welcome screen, email related to the course, submissions, if content has been uploaded, and... They're just popping into a learning resource here. As you can see, and I'm not really giving you the world's greatest tour here, but it's an environment in which the learning material will be located, as I said, in a fairly standard interface. Learning management systems, very popular. Let's get out of here. There we go. I'm afraid to think of how many copies of my browser I'm going to have by the end of this session, because Windows opens up a new browser each time, which is very strange. Virtually every college and every university that offers online learning, which is virtually every college and university, has a learning management system these days. And what's happening out there in the field, you read the discussion list and things like that, is there's now developing a bit of pushback against them. And the reason for this is instructors especially, but also students to some degree, find learning management systems to be very static, very rigidly structured. A lot of people argue that learning management systems are suitable only for a show and tell type of learning or presentation. And so while they've been widely adopted, people are beginning to scout around for alternatives. Another thing with learning management systems is that in the last couple of years, 2-3 years ago, they started to get really, really expensive. WebCT started off free, if you can believe it, but now will cost a medium-sized institution tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to operate. Consequently, what we're seeing in the academic side of e-learning, at least, is a movement toward open source learning management systems. Two of them are worth noting. I don't have the links up there because I ran out of room, but one of them is Moodle, M-O-O-D-L-E, and another one is Saki, S-A-K-A-I. These have, Saki especially, has a large consortium of mostly U.S., but also some Canadian and European universities lined up behind it. It's a major development effort. Moodle is more of a grassroots development using an open source programming language called PHP. It doesn't really have an institutional backing, but it's got a lot of user backing. Both of these are very good LMSs, certainly equal, in my view, in functionality to the commercial LMS systems that you can buy. The big difference is that the commercial LMS systems will typically hook into a student management and information system, whereas the open source ones won't, because it takes cooperation with like SAP and companies like that in order to tie into these back-end systems. So if you're in an institutional framework, you're probably still looking at the commercial system. But if you don't care what grades people got, then the open source is certainly the way to go. Now let me ask, how many of you have heard of learning objects? Well, not too bad. You see, the idea is, once we have online courses, and once we have fairly standardized systems to deliver online courses, again, it's a really natural leap to come up with a concept where you have little bits of reusable digital content so that you can take this digital content, put it in one course here, and put it in another course over there so that you don't have to develop all the same content over and over again. In a paper I wrote, I used the example of trigonometry. There's only one way to do trigonometry. It's not like you can go in and like wing it. It works in a pretty specific way, which means that, you know, theoretically, you only need one bit of learning explaining trigonometry. Right, you need a whole bunch of bits, but you know what I mean, one bit of learning explaining what a sine curve is. Now, once you've got that, then the idea is you can share it around the world to everybody else, every other course that's ever going to do trigonometry. So math courses, electronics courses, maybe engineering courses. I don't know if engineers use trig because I never studied enough of it, but you know what I mean. So, thus we have the concept of learning objects. The architect of learning objects was Wayne Hodgins, and he used the analogy that these little bits of content are like Legos, and you create a course just by getting your collection of Legos and snapping them together. And the Legos each are a little independent chunk of, well, in this case, plastic. In that case, digital content. They can stand alone. It doesn't matter which Legos you use. You can always put them together. Now, of course, you have some pretty wild courses going on, right? You know, beginning with horse biology to architecture to flight maintenance. But that's how it's supposed to work. And typically, they would be organized in a more or less sensible fashion. David Weiland, who I link to as well, is another major proponent of learning objects. He describes them as being like molecules. And so you can put little molecules together and create things like, well, this podium or that screen. And different molecules fit together differently. There have been an awful lot, huge amount of work over, say, the last 5 or 6 years in learning objects. Because it's not simply the creation of digital content. In order for it to work the way it's intended, this digital content has to have certain properties. Norm Friesen, who works at Athabasca University, has characterized the basic properties that have to be reusable, which means you can use them over and over again. I guess you knew that. Discoverable, and that's the trick. If there is a learning object on trigonometry out there somewhere, and if you want to create a course using that module, using that learning object, then somehow you have to find it. And if we keep in mind that there are billions of web pages out there, this apparently trivial task becomes rather less trivial. You might say, well, just Google it, but you know what happens as well as I do if you use Google and type in trigonometry, like 1.4 million results. We need a more precise system of locating learning objects. And then finally, they need to be modular. They have to have a similar structure to each other so that they can stand alone as self-contained units of learning. These requirements have spawned an entire industry. And I tell you, it is an industry. Here are some of the acronyms involved in this industry. IMS stands for Instructional Management Systems. SCORM stands for Shareable Courseware Object Reference Model. And you don't need to remember that. The main thing you need to keep in mind is when people start flinging around names like IMS, SCORM, CanCore, LOM, or Learning Object Metadata, these are all slightly different. They're very similar. Ways of representing information about learning objects. To solve especially the discoverability problem, but also to solve usability problem, what the industry did is adapt XML to the description of learning objects. XML, familiar to everyone? Yes or no? No. Okay. That's okay. HTML, how many of you know about that? Okay. If you go to a web page, any old web page, and you do a right click on it and view the source, you see the code that was used to make up the web page. And in this code, what you're going to see is a whole bunch of angle brackets. So you see an angle bracket P and a closing angle bracket. The set of angle brackets and the stuff inside, the elements, that constitutes HTML. So angle bracket P, angle bracket, that means insert a new paragraph. Angle bracket HR, angle bracket, that means put a horizontal rule or a line here. If you want a link, it's angle bracket A and then the location of the link. And so on. So that's HTML. XML is just like HTML, except instead of focusing on how web pages are displayed, it focuses on how content is structured. So an XML file might, for example, describe an article on the World Wide Web. Very common use of XML. So think about what sort of properties an article might have. Well, have a title, right? Have, say, a link where it's located. It might have a description, you know, a little summary of the article. So an XML file would use angle brackets to describe the structure. So you have angle bracket, title, angle bracket, and then the title, and then another angle bracket to close that title. Angle bracket, link, angle bracket, and then the location, the link, and then another angle bracket to close it. So basically, it's creating a structured description of a resource. You might ask yourself, well, why don't they just type it out in text? It'd be a lot easier. But the idea of representing information, like the description of an article in XML, is that XML is machine readable. That means that One computer over here can access an XML file here, and because it's in a standard structure, the computer that's doing the accessing knows where all the information is. It knows how to find the title. It knows how to find the link, because it's always going to be in the same place. The angle bracket, that's just a convention. We could have used anything. But the main idea here is that it's structured data representing information. This is a huge development. If you get nothing else out of this presentation, get this anyways, that underlying the web is a much larger, still under construction, set of structured data. It's what sometimes people, when they talk about the semantic web, that's what they're referring to, are all these XML descriptions. Because if you think about it, you can use XML to describe anything. I just showed you, or described how to describe a resource using XML. But you can use XML to describe people. Angle bracket name, close angle bracket, Stephen Downs, close it off. Angle bracket address, angle bracket, Moncton, New Brunswick, close it off. Angle bracket phone number, angle bracket, you don't get my phone number. Right? Same sort of thing. You can describe organizations, right? Angle bracket name, angle bracket, RCMP. Angle bracket department, angle bracket, justice. And you do all of that. Events, angle bracket start time, angle bracket, 9 a.m. Anything you can describe in XML. And that means anything you can describe, that description can be read by a computer program somewhere. Which, and this is the secret behind learning objects, it makes any bit of information discoverable by an automatically running computer program. And this is the concept behind learning objects. We take this little bit of content, a web page or a course or a learning object about trigonometry, take this, we create this metadata description, and we toss it on the web. Now, our learning object can be discovered by any of these other systems. So that if you are out there creating a math course or an electronics course and you need something on trigonometry, you just tap into this, have your computer automatically look for stuff on trigonometry. Computer goes out, looks at all of these XML files, says, oh yeah, this one matches, the title is trigonometry, and brings it back to you. All happens automatically. It's like Google, but without the searching, which is a much improved Google. Let me just pause there. Does that make sense to everyone? It's a neat idea, isn't it? I spent years of my life on this. And not just me, either. There are now hundreds of thousands of people working on this. IMS is a huge U.S. consortium. It includes most of the universities and so on. Question?
Are you able to show us exactly what you said by accessing the internet now?
Sure. Yeah, I can. Good idea. Why didn't I think of that? Because, well, you get on a roll. All right, let's call up a browser. Here's an XML file. It's one of mine. This XML file describes the most recent contents of my newsletter. I do a newsletter, I send it out, but more importantly, I make an XML version of it. Let's just make this a bit bigger. Wow, that's big. How's that? All right.
So, my newsletter in this particular XML language is a channel. Kind of like television channels, except they're web. They're like web channels. The name of the channel is OL Daily. And as you can see, I've indicated in XML, you see the title tag there?
Now can you use the Phil Donahue microphone?
So the title tag, then the name or the title, and then the closed title tag. Where do you find my newsletter? Well, the link, right? Here's the link tag. Here's the link. And somewhere off the screen is the closed link tag. Description of it. There's the description. You know, a few lines of text. And then I close the description tag. The neat thing about XML is that anyone can create one. This turns out to be really important because it has allowed there to be a wide usage base to be created in a very short time. I once wrote an article. This type of XML is called RSS, and I'll come back to that. I once wrote an article, how to create an RSS feed with a web server, notepad, and a beer. And in fact, the web server is optional. So anyhow, this goes on, and the XML file goes on. I have a series of items in my XML file. In this one, there's about 8 items. Each one of these items corresponds to a separate article listed on my website. So each item will have a title. This one, the title is Amtech 2005. The link, and there's the link, somebody out there in the world, on a website called Rick's Cafe. Actually, Rick's Cafe Canadian, can't see the end of it there, has this information. And by putting it in XML now, I'm making it possible for other computers to locate this and to display it. How's that? Now, I'm not going to show you learning object metadata. First of all, because it looks a lot like that. But secondly, because it has 87 different tags, the files are like yay long. So, but when I say learning object metadata, think more of the same.
So now how do you grab these when you tap into
them? Okay, now well, that's about 8 slides now, but that's okay. There's a couple of ways. Let's kill this. Here's one way. Just use my web browser. Now, this is a way that doesn't usually work. Now, that sort of looks nice. But it's true, though. Might as well tell you. That sort of looks nice. Because what I've done is I've taken the XML, and then because XML is very structured, I can create a design or a format for it using what's called a styling language, and in particular, a language called XSLT. And the idea is, if I apply that style to that XML file, I get a nice display. But most people in the world don't have XSLT kicking around, which is why it doesn't work a lot. So what happens is, what they do typically is they access websites on the World Wide Web called aggregators. And as I say, we'll come back to this a little later on, but an aggregator is a computer program that goes out searching for XML files and brings them in. Now, when it brings it in, it displays them really nicely. So here's one. This is a site called Blogline. What it does is it accesses XML created by weblogs, which I'll come back to. Here are the different weblogs or channels that I created. There's OL Daily. Remember, we just saw the XML for OL Daily a couple minutes ago. Now that's the basic channel listing for OL Daily here on BlogLines. BlogLines is some company in the States. This is the neat thing about XML. I don't know them. They don't know me. I don't want to know them. They really don't want to know about me. But our content can interact. Here is OL Daily as displayed by BlogLines. And as you can see there, there's the Amtech item that I showed you from the previous slide. Amtech 2005, there's the title. The link is behind the title, so I can click on the link. Click on the link, and lo and behold, there's Rick's Cafe Canadian. Or Canadian. Description, so on. So typically, people don't read XML directly unless they're really weird like me. People typically use software applications such as BlogLines in order to access XML. So you can see where this is all going with learning objects, right? You've got your learning objects described in XML. And you have a program that's kind of like this. In the world of e-learning, if we had a program like this that manipulated, you know, found, stored, allowed you to search for XML files, that kind of a system is called a learning content management system. And there's a whole other industry devoted to that. And these days, actually, every learning management system says it's a learning content management system. And every learning content management system says it's also an LMS. It's all sort of smooshed together. So a designer, if you were designing a course and you had the hundreds of thousands of dollars to set up one of these LCMSs, learning content management systems, they're not cheap, then you would access your list of different resources, instead of news, edgy bloggers, EMI and stuff, it'd be like, you know, trigonometry, geometry, fractals, calculus, whatever your subject areas were. And you do your search, you'd find all of these learning objects that were represented inside the system in XML. Yeah? Yeah? Okay, I'm sorry, I missed the last part of that.
Well, you have IMS and Swarm.
Right.
Are you so different that you pick one and, you know, like a month a year from now, or do
you have a month? Okay, yeah. How different are IMS and Swarm? They are almost identical. IMS. See, this in the world of standards, and this applies for everything from road lanes to light bulbs to aircraft navigation, there's a process that you go through. And basically it's a three-step process. The first part of the process is what they call a specification. That's where an organization or a company says, here's how we think it should be. And they put it out. IMS is a specification. It's mostly a proposal. So nobody actually uses IMS. They take that as a reference point. Then the second step in standardization is the formalization of the standard. Okay, this is the standard. And it gets passed by different standards bodies. IEEE is one example. ISO, the International Standards Organization, is another. So what happened is they took IMS and they submitted it to a standards body, IEEE, International Engineers Electronics, you know the guys. And IEEE looked at this, they made some minor changes, and then they said, okay, this is the Learning Object Metadata Standard, 1484 point something something. I used to know that. It's just sad. So now you have the standard. But the thing is, the standard is only a standard. It needs to be applied in different areas, right? If you have a standard for light bulbs, now you need to think about, well, what about this light bulb? What about that light bulb? What about light bulbs on runways? What about street lights? So for any standard now, what you are going to get is a set or a series of applications. And the precise description of the standard in that application is called an application profile. SCORM is an application profile. It is an implementation of IEEE Learning Object Metadata specifically designed for use by the U.S. military and the U.S. military suppliers and therefore most of the U.S. That's not an exaggeration. You go to the U.S. today and you talk Learning Object Metadata, what you mean is SCORM. Because the U.S. military put something like $600 million into development efforts and it just like, it ripples. And so everybody in the U.S. uses SCORM. Canadian university context has its own application profile. It's called CANCOR. And it was developed by Norm Friesen at Athabasca plus a couple people in New Brunswick, Sue Fisher and Tony Roberts. It's very similar to SCORM. The only difference, practical difference between them is in SCORM, some elements will be required, whereas in CANCOR, some elements are optional. The changes are very minor. If you had Learning Object Metadata in CANCOR, you could very easily convert it to Learning Object Metadata in SCORM, and vice versa. Bottom line, if you're a commercial developer, develop in SCORM. If you're non-commercial in the academic sector, develop in CANCOR. Go ahead.
I'd like to come back to the idea of aggregators. I find that really interesting, but as you can understand, our environment involves a lot of secure information.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, is there anything between an LCMS, which tends to be sort of institutional based, as I understand, and the aggregators that are web based that can take into consideration our security concerns? And the reason I'm coming to this is I work in a large organization and we have our own internal training, but there are colleges, for example, that might need the same training or police agencies that need the same training. And to this point, we're having trouble, I think, knowing how to share what we've developed.
Sure. And that the problem of security, for those on the microphone, the question was about security in RSS aggregators. Probably the problem of security doesn't go away in RSS. And it doesn't go away because you're dealing with the same kind of stuff, right? Really, when you think about it, an XML file is just the same as a web page. The bad news is it means it's as open and insecure as a web page. The good news is the same methods that you use to secure web pages, such as an intranet, such as a VPN or virtual private network, can be used to secure XML. So if you don't want people reading your XML, then you put one or more layers of security on top of that. The typical security, kind of loosey-goosey security, would be to use something like htaccess, which is a server-based, web server-based system of requiring passwords to access certain files. And then the aggregator, when it sends the request, it would send not just the request, but also the user information and the password information. And you can ramp up your security from there, right? You can do IP validation on aggregators. You can do various degrees of authentication on aggregators. The intent of XML is that it be free and open. And then we'll come back to that in a little bit. And we're going to see a lot more of that. But insofar as XML is a web resource, then it can take advantage of any existing means of securing web resources. So it doesn't mean you have to use something completely different. And the neat thing is, too, because it's distributed, like XML is really distributed. You just picture it in your mind for a second. You have a file here, 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 all over the place. Colleges can have them, police academies can have them, cab companies can have them. I don't know why they'd have them, but they could, right? You can have them anywhere, and your aggregator just picks them up, which means you can have a very fine-grained, layered security. You make some of your content publicly available, some of it available internally, some of it available only to politicians, whatever. And this kind of security can be repeated throughout the network. So the network itself looks very different depending on who you are. So, like, if I log on, to NRC through the VPN and IP authentication and blood type certification and so on. Okay, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but it feels like that. Then I could access, still all of the public XML files, but the NRC files, and because I have, believe it or not, security clearance, I can access other government files. I can tap in. I work from time to time with the Department of National Defense, which really surprises me. Because who would have thought, 20 years ago, anyhow. I can access their stuff. We've actually shared some work in RSS or XML content creators and aggregators. So I tap into get their stuff. So you have a very personalized, depending on your levels of access and your interest, collection of material you can draw from. So actually, my take on this is by using XML, we're actually able to enhance security through distribution of resources. How's that for more of an answer than you wanted? Anything else? Is this interesting so far?
Yeah.
Cool. This is just like where we are. We haven't even actually it's not true. We've kind of wandered around a little bit, so you've gotten bits and pieces of what's coming, but that's okay. Now, that wasn't Merlot. It must be merlot.org. I always forget URLs. I hardly ever type URLs anymore. If I want something, see, I use a web browser called Firefox instead of Internet Explorer. Many reasons for that, but one reason is this is a Google search. And so if I want something, usually I just type what I want in the Google search and I get it. So I hardly ever type URLs. But I can't really see what I'm doing, so. There we go. This is going back to the original question, how do you read these things? This is a website called Merlot. What Merlot is sort of a site or an organization that aggregates learning objects. I say sort of because there are some differences between the way they do it and the way I think it should be done. But nonetheless, it still illustrates the concept. And so, browse the collection, arts, business, education, so on. And that quickly, I can get to a learning object. Peer review, member contents, here's the location. And now we are in the learning object itself. I would have probably picked a more visual one, but yeah, I ended up with mathematics. The golden string is 101101, so on. If you're interested in that and you needed to find it, you go to Merlo, there it is. Okay, let's get rid of this. All right. I had allocated 7 minutes to that slide. Now, let's take up this all the next logical step. Yeah, and it just kills me when I look at this, you know, because you look at all these consortia of people and organizations, and it's like they're drawn forward by some force of inevitability. You do one thing, and the next thing is, of course, this is what you do. You have learning objects. You have a learning management system. What does a learning management system do? Well, it presents objects, learning resources, to students. Right? Presents one. Now, when we talked about online courses, about page turners, and how boring it is to just present one. So what do? You organize the presentation of learning resources so that it is based on interaction between the learner and the material. The simplest example of this is the test in Loop. You go through some material. You learn a little bit about trigonometry. Then you hit a test. And it tests you on trigonometry. And if you're like me, you fail the test. And so you loop. And you go through material on trigonometry again. And you hit the test again, and you go through the loop, you keep going through the loop until you pass the test. That's a very simple example of learning design. Here's another example. You're going through learning material, and the system asks you a question. What is your age? And you type in your age. And if you type in an age below 30, you get the mod rad version. And if you type in an age above 30, you get the stodgy square version. Okay, there it goes up. But you see what I mean? Based on input by the student, you can alter the display of the type of material. Well, give this concept to computer designers and you get an industry, which is the way it usually works. There are all kinds of ways of organizing material based on different answers or different submissions the student will make. The role, because you have different students in different roles. Minimally a role might be instructor student, or it might be experienced student, novice student, or it might be student from Alberta, student from Saskatchewan. You might have slightly different content to show. So there's all these different roles. And so what learning design is a standardized way of representing ways of displaying content based on roles and student interactions. So that's the definition. And the really neat thing, this is the kicker, it's all in XML. The very same system that we used to describe learning objects, we can use to describe learning design. I'm not going to show you some learning design XML because at this point it's just all squiggles. I'd have to sit there and say, okay, this. But think of it, like angle bracket if something is true, close angle bracket then, and then the name of a learning object. It would be something like that. So basically you have logic built into your XML. Big industry. There's that picture. It's sort of a typical little flow chart. It's going to show you some stuff. If something is there, here's one of these loops. That little box there says try again. That's the point where I stall on these online courses, right? Here's try again test. I'm scratching my head, try again test. It reminds me of the video games when I was a kid, right? You never get past level 2. Go against the monster, die. Try again. Go against the monster, die. Try again.
That's why I don't have any life savings. Learning design right now is at the specification stage. It's a proposal by IMS. It's in the process of being standardized. There's pushback to learning design because it's closed, it's inflexible, it's you know, a graph and branch kind of way of representing learning material. If I was doing this talk in a learning design mode, you couldn't ask me questions because your questions are open-ended. And if I'm learning design, I can't just improvise. So, you know, people aren't always comfortable with it. But if you're doing training manuals, standardized training, things like that, then learning design is going to have a wide applicability. Just in the very early stages now of software that creates learning design and displays learning design. There's nothing really commonly commercially available yet. There are some beta stuff out there. Well, I guess probably compared very high end, you know, like the hundreds of thousands of dollars range, there is stuff. But I mean, stuff you can buy off the shelf doesn't exist yet. But it's coming, and it is hitting this field by storm. The other thing I have up there, and I'll just mention this briefly because it's another IMS specification, is content packaging. Content packaging exists because in a lot of cases you can't do all of your learning online. In a lot of cases you don't have internet access. So you can't just be given a web page, because a web page typically has some text, some images, might have a movie, might be two web pages which are linked. So And you wouldn't be able to access all of these things if you weren't online. What a content package does is it takes all the resources associated with a learning object and smooshes them together into a single package. So if you picture a web page, a couple of images. Look at this slide, for example. This slide actually consists of about five or six objects.
Right, here's a little box, that's one little bit of content. Here's an image, that's another little bit of content. This link here, which is where you found the image, another little bit. Title, that's another little bit. So it's five or six distinct pieces. In content packaging, you list each of the distinct pieces, and then you put those distinct pieces in a subdirectory underneath the list. And then you take all of that together and you zip it up. And you put that on a CD or something like that. And it's a completely self-contained content package.
I'm not sure I'm thrilled with that microphone. It's weird. Anyhow. All right, it's 10:15, and I'm going to stop here after part one of four. That's okay. I don't think that's a problem. And we'll take our break. When I come back, I'm going to skip lightly through the trends and then linger more on e-learning 2.0, because e-learning 2.0 picks up right with things like RSS aggregators and things like that. And so that seems to follow the line of your interest in questioning. So I'll talk quite a bit more behind that. I've got more sites to show you and things like that. And then I'll talk about the future very briefly. So we're not behind schedule. We're just on a revised schedule. So I'll see you in 15 minutes.
Would you actually get into... we're not all conversant with...
Sure.
Making program. When you talked about the angle brackets and so on, are you going to show